Hi, and welcome to Pete's Pub, where you can sit back, have an adult beverage, and enjoy listening to me and my guests talk about things we enjoy or are important to us. It's Sunday, June 29th, 2025. My name is Pete Kemmerer, and I'm really glad to be with you. Today, I'm honored to speak with my friend Denise Tikowski about her new book, Let's Talk About It, A Healing Journey Through Pain to Peace. I say brand new, but she worked on it for about 7 years, and it's already number 26 on Amazon. I have to apologize a bit for the audio in this interview, which initially had a terrible echo. I did manage to fix it for the most part, and I have since found the setting I had wrong, so it won't happen again. As it is, Denise may be a little soft in some spots, and I might be a little loud. Kind of like real life. I'll have links up in the show notes for anything linkable. So without further ado, here's my interview with Denise Tikowski. Oh, and always remember, if you can be a bass player, be one. If not, date or marry one. Bass players are the best. So joining us is Denise Tikowski. Did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, you did.
And she's the author of Let's Talk About It, A Healing Journey Through Pain to Peace, which just came out this month on Amazon. And where else can people find your book?
You can find it on my website, DeniseTikowski.com.
Okay.
Hopefully soon to be in bookstores everywhere.
Cool. Yeah. It's funny. We met each other back at a weird company. We both called it weird, so I can say it's weird. In the mid-2010s. And I never would have guessed any of this stuff. I mean, any of it. I never made the connection or realized that so many women were sexually abused by people they knew growing up. Because, I mean, maybe I was just plain naive. I mean, I didn't even understand racism when I was 11, 12 years old. There were a lot of things that resonated with me in your book, and it was a hard read because I could relate to so much. You clearly and graphically put yourself out there right on the cover. Now, and I'm going to share a picture that people won't be able to see, obviously, on audio, but fear. Truth with a question mark, not good enough, anxiety, poverty, avoidance, addiction, anger, molestation, and dysfunction. I mean, that's quite the laundry list.
Yes.
How did you find the strength and the voice to even talk about each of those in the book?
I think when I first had the idea of taking a picture of my to-do list of healing.
Yeah.
I'll call it. Okay. I really think it was divinely inspired. We all have to-do lists, and words on paper don't really keep us accountable to get things done, to get them all done. You know, it's nice to check off one or two of those and you feel accomplished. But I really needed something to keep me accountable. And in going through the healing process and identifying the pain and where in my body I felt it,
yeah,
I just thought, let me write it. Let me write it where I feel it, and then I want to see it. And that picture really kept me accountable to stay on the healing journey, because I mean, I would have got to the first one on paper, saw and felt how difficult that was, and probably stopped.
Maybe some people don't know either. I'm sure they don't. Is when did you start writing this book?
I started writing it back in 2018.
Okay, so that was a few years after I had left our weird company.
Yes.
And is that when you took the picture as well?
That's what, at the end of 2018. Yeah, I was, I've always wanted to write a book. Yeah. I liked writing as a child in diaries and a little older in journals. I was on school newspapers, and that was a way to write out my feelings or to speak my feelings when I couldn't use my voice. And then it all came together. The catalyst with 2018 was a perfect storm of circumstances, being unhappy, the Cosby trial, that was churning some memories that I had really buried and not looked at for a long time. And I just started to question everything, you know, all my beliefs and all the ways I felt. And I was teetering on another depression at that time.
Yeah.
And I was really concerned about my well-being. So all of that together with the picture and wanting to write a book, I felt all that would keep me accountable to finally get all the way through it.
Just getting something like that started is very difficult because it's like, okay, now I'm going to go to the top of this hill and I'm going to start going down the other side. But once I start, I can't stop. I have this emotional baggage and I have all this going on in me. And I know once I start this thing, it's just going to open up a whole can of worms. And finally, you had decided that that was a good thing for you. That can of worms had to be opened up because it was killing you. I mean, it had to be killing you at the time. Did you start the book before or after you got filed for divorce or you got divorced?
I started writing it before.
Okay. And once you got into the process, I guess it became pretty clear that, you know, I got to take a different path here because this is crazy, right?
You know, it started out, I was very angry in 2018, bringing up all these old memories and the pain. I started to get angry. And when I started to write the book, it was really a finger pointing blame type thing.
Yeah.
That was showing up for me. And I think that once I started to take care of some of the issues that I was having and feeling through the pain, I think in 2022 is when I started to maybe rewrite the book in a more healed and positive way.
Yeah. I was going to ask you later, wouldn't it have been easier to just, I mean, for some of the things that happened, and I'll get into some of them if you don't mind, so people have an understanding of how, well, frankly, dark a lot of this was. And it's not just for you, and I know this is your personal story, you know, that you've told, but my God, I know, because with me too, I know that people are going to empathize with you on a lot of these things because, you know, there aren't any Camelots out there. You know, people have difficult times and they can share a lot of the emotions that you had and the damage that you endured by reading this book. And I think it's helpful. Okay. Now I don't know that the divine part of it is for everybody. That's fine. Everybody has their own way of dealing with things, but just the fact of how you did decide to not blame people is amazing to me because it would have been easy. You know, my mom is a nutbag. My dad beat me. The babysitter was abusive. The babysitter's teenage daughter was a mess and beat us up and did things to, and we'll get into that a little bit. But there were so many things, you know. Do you still battle those words at all, or do you think you've really come out complete, or is this just an ongoing thing that you need to be like consistent and maintain yourself with?
I think probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I really feel at peace.
Yeah.
With myself and my life and who I am. And it keeps me grounded. I very rarely feel anxious or an unrest anymore. But certainly, some things thinking back might have a little bit of a trigger,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I think I can relate to that. Can you recommend some tools for other people who might be dealing with some of the things you've had to deal with? I mean, to get you from the beginning of this where it was just woof to now you are at basically at peace with yourself and happy with your life. I mean, are there some tools that you developed that are used along the way?
Certainly this book is not my entire story. It's a small fraction of it, but I guess my idea was to go back as far in my life towards the beginning where these words began to, you know, to the pivotal moments where these things were created in my nervous system. Mm-hmm. And give examples of those and how maybe repeated incidences just, you know, continue to trigger me throughout my adult life. I think one of the biggest things for me with healing, and I learned this from following Kyle Cease, is don't argue with reality. Yeah, that's where our suffering begins.
You mentioned that in the book, and I couldn't agree more.
I certainly wish my childhood would have been lovely.
But it is what it was.
Carefree and all that, yes. But it was what it was. Yeah. I didn't have control over it. And for many, many, many years, Pete, I was just holding on to that fantasy of what it should have been like.
Yeah.
And just feeling a lot of anger about that and sad for myself at 6, 10, 12, you know.
Yeah.
But now I can't, not, it's done, you know.
Yeah.
It's going to be changed.
Right.
So
then the question now would be, okay, so where do we go from here? Because I can't change that. I can change what I do today. I can try to plan a little bit for tomorrow, but I mean, basically everything that's happened has happened, you know, and how am I going to deal with that going forward? Am I going to spend the rest of my life feeling that way or am I going to feel better? And you seem to have found the secret to that. It was years later after this had all started processing and affecting your life during the Bill Cosby trial. That was the catalyst, the word you used, yes, to help you face the truth of what happened to you many years ago, being molested by someone you trusted. You know, why do you think it took so long and why that particular verdict for you to be able to start facing your life head on? Because that was really the beginning of the whole process and search for a better way of life. Why do you think it took so long and it was that thing?
I think that trial was happening at a time where Me Too was becoming very popular and people were out there speaking their truth. They were out there talking about what happened to them. And I, as a child, thought it didn't happen to me. It was my fault.
Yeah.
I made some bad decision and it was my fault. And in watching those women testify and be so courageous, I felt that maybe I was wrong about it being my fault.
Right. And you had the courage to actually give that. You had the courage to actually, now, you know, at that point, it gave you a little bit of courage to actually think that, you know, maybe it wasn't. You know, maybe this was done to me, and now I got to deal with this.
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, in hindsight, it wasn't your fault at all. This stuff was just not your fault. I mean, it wasn't my fault that my dad was an alcoholic, but he was. One of the things that jumped out at me, too, was didn't your mother know about what your babysitter and her teenage daughter were doing to you guys?
I can't imagine she did. Wow. I mean, we never talked about it. We didn't, you know, kids were to be seen and not heard, and you were to respect adults,
yeah,
and do what they say. So there was no speaking up about things.
Right. Plus, you were threatened not to say anything by,
yes,
your babysitter.
Yeah.
You know, and so you weren't going to say anything, or your siblings weren't going to say anything. So, yeah. That's a hard one because that was straight up mental and physical abuse. I mean, by someone that you're supposed to be respecting. So that's a hard one, you know, because you're so young.
Such a young age.
How old were you then?
I was 6, 7, 8. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. And same thing for Lou, your stepdad. he didn't know anything that was going on there either.
No, I mean, they never mentioned it. They never asked us anything. No, it was just drop us off, pick us up.
Wow, and 2.5 years of that.
Yeah.
Wow. And then poor baby Sue. That was heartbreaking.
Oh, my goodness.
Dear Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. I can remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah. I mean, these are out of context for people that are listening, but you got to read the book. I had to stop reading at that point. I paused for like, I don't know, a few hours because I just had to collect myself because it's just heartbreaking. I mean, and I'm a pop now, so I'm really sensitive to, you know, what happens to little kids. And I'm very protective of my grandchildren. Yeah, that's a tough one.
That was, even as a mother, reading it and rereading it, yeah.
You were witness to your mom and dad physically fighting each other, not infrequently. Infidelity was baked into your psyche on both parts, really. I mean, your dad did it, maybe your stepdad did it on the down low a little more, but your mom was like, you know, right out there, you know, and she was teaching lessons that, you know, men are there for you to take control over. You're in charge. You blah, blah, you know, and a totally messed up view of relationships. You were forced to move like 20 times before you were even out of school.
Yes.
I mean, so if people would think about that for a minute, that's a long time. I mean, that's a lot of moves in a short amount of time. You have no chance of maintaining friendships or relationships with people for your entire life up to when you're out of school. So the only people that were constants in your life were
my family.
Right. And your family was dysfunctional. Totally dysfunctional. I mean, it's crazy.
So that's it. That's all you know. So that becomes normal.
Yeah,
that becomes the normal.
And that's all you knew. I mean, I can tell you some stories, and I will at some point off the air. But I know a person who was basically farmed out to men starting when she was 3.5 years old. It's the most heartbreaking story of my whole life. And this person, that was the normal for this person. That person really never completely recovered from that. And for you, I mean, this is another thing that resonated with me. It just reminded me of this other person, and her own mother did this to her. And it made me angry, and it made me want to cry. I mean, your mom lied to you about a whole bunch of things, like who your birth father was.
Yes.
Couldn't even be honest about that. Why do you think she lied about that?
I mean, I can only guess about some things. She was very unhappy. She had a lot of anger about her own childhood and upbringing and towards her own parents. I think she was broken and maybe felt like her life was out of her control. So really the only thing she could control was her children.
Yeah.
And the love she couldn't get from anywhere else, her family, her parents, her partners, she was trying to manipulate out of her children. And I feel like that was a big part of her deception.
Yeah.
And manipulation. It was really manipulation.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. And again, it has none of that had anything to do with you guys as far as a reason, a cause. You know, that was all on her. And again, it resonated with me because I would think about my dad and why he did some of the things he did. In retrospect, it was because of not only the alcohol, but his own issues, you know. And I didn't do anything wrong. You know, that whole concept of, you know, not being good enough, not doing, you know, on my 15th birthday, my dad told me, "You're not worth the air you breathe." Right before school.
Unbelievable.
Right. And it's like, but it wasn't because of anything I did or was, it was because of my father, you know? And so I forgave him for all that stuff. It was tough, but I think you're right about, you know, healing starts with forgiveness. And if you can't really forgive, I mean, you can't heal, because you're just going to fester like a wound. How old were you when Mr. Harper in your book sexually molested you?
I was 10.
10 years old. Wow. And then you wrote in there that it happened, it was terrible and everything, but you went back the next day.
Yeah.
Because he said he had a job for you, and he had told you to come back, and that if you thought if you could make money for your parents, maybe they wouldn't fight so much or even stop talking about getting a divorce. So you were already at 10 years old, completely affected by your parents' relationship with each other and with you. And to the point where you were willing to take this risk when you went back the next day, because, you know, if it works out, then, well, okay, I can make some money and maybe I can make mommy and daddy, you know, calm down a little bit and we can have some stability.
Yeah. And I think the programming, right, that you hear, respect your elders, do as you're told, you know, don't question, those types of things. And he told me he had a job. I had accepted it. And I felt like I needed to go back because my parents talked about, you know, the importance of showing up for work and that type of thing. Yeah.
I can't imagine the amount of shame that you felt after going back the second day. It happened again. And then you had to throw the towel in on that whole thing because you tried and you probably felt just exasperated and scared and shamed. And I don't know how you survived that. That's crazy.
Honestly, Pete, I was more afraid of getting in trouble at home for that whole thing.
Again, feeling that it's somehow your fault and you're going to get in trouble. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And, you know, I was always so afraid of going home and wondering which one of them were leaving. Yeah. Was one of them going to be gone? Were they both going to be gone? What was going to happen to us? You know, and that was a lot around money and the dysfunction. And I just wanted to help. I was trying to find ways to help.
Yeah.
To keep them together.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because they were all you had. Again, going back to moving around and not having lasting relationships, they were it. Your family was it. I mean, I was never sexually molested, thank goodness, but my dad's physical and mental abuse made me make a lot of horrible life decisions, you know, before I caught myself. I mean, a lot of self-medicating went on in my teen years. But I was 180 degrees different than you on that. I was wishing very much so that my mom would leave my dad and I could just live with her. Did you have wishes of escape back then that you fantasized about?
I don't think escape. I just wanted my family, all six of us, to stay together.
Yeah.
And I hoped that we could find a way to love each other.
Yeah. What role, if any, do you think going to therapy at 24 played in your ability to recover and rebuild your life years later? Do you think it helped?
I'm not sure. I was able to talk a little bit about the sexual abuse during those sessions.
Yeah.
But her methods with writing my name on a piece of paper, excuse me,
sure,
like I'm a doormat, and her telling me that people that have been abused might become abusers themselves, I feel like it was more detrimental at that time for me to the therapy that I went through. And I didn't go back to therapy until maybe 10, 15 years later, just couples therapy.
Okay.
Trying to hold together my first relationship.
Right.
And that didn't work.
No.
So, yeah, therapy really wasn't it for me.
Yeah. This was more of a personal journey for you that you had to find your way. Yeah.
Right.
Did you ever contemplate suicide?
Only that one time I talk about in the book where I was a single mom and I was just so overwhelmed and exhausted that I thought maybe they'd be better off without me. You know, it'd be better if I didn't wake up.
And that obviously is crazy talk because you're a pretty wonderful person. I know this.
Thank you.
Oh, it's true. It's true.
Only once. But then my faith just got me out of that.
I met you back in the mid-2010s on the outside. Here's what I wrote here, my notes. On the outside, you were a sweet, kind, intelligent, and effective administrative assistant at a dysfunctional company. Imagine Denise Stokowski working at a dysfunctional company. Well, we did together. And we both left because it was dysfunctional. We couldn't get things.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I do feel bad for our boss who passed away over the last few years. I remember, without naming him, he was a good person. Once he got sick and he started realizing his mortality was closer than he may have thought when he was racing motorcycles and being a crazy man and doing everything at that company. But he was more of a human being at the end. And when I left, I gave him a big hug. I told him that I loved him and I wished the best for him. And I'm sorry I had to go, but I had to provide better for my family and I needed to work somewhere where I could make a difference. And I felt that I couldn't do that anymore, but I did wish him the best. And then, you know, a few years later he passed, but he was a good guy in general.
He was.
What was going on in your head around this time? Is you were in the beginning or kind of into already having marital issues and processing that and trying to decide how you're going to hold this family together. I mean, first you're trying to hold your birth family together. Now you have your own family and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, I got to hold this family together somehow.
It was very hard. I saw a lot of similarities with the family I created from the family I grew up in.
Yeah, that's always a fear.
I mean, as hard as I tried to make it different, I think focusing on what went wrong or what was going wrong just created more of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I felt very badly that I wasn't able to overcome some of those things that I brought them in from my childhood into my life with my children.
And again, there was probably no small bit of, you know, this is my fault, right?
Yeah.
That you had to deal with. I think back then when I knew you at the company, you were pretty much into what your son was doing musically, your sons.
Yes.
So was that a big help, having that focus and that time to spend, you know, like you would go see your sons and, you know, be proud of them? And I mean, didn't that help a lot?
It did. I mean, I realize now that I was kind of raising my boys in a way that I was trying to fix my own childhood. So I, in my mind, saw the similarities of theirs and mine, and I was trying to fix theirs the way I wish someone could have fixed mine.
Yeah.
But they really were two different things.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have my childhood.
Nope.
They had something much different. And I just wanted them to be themselves. I didn't want them to have to worry about our, you know, their parents' relationships and money and all those things. And as much as I encourage them to be themselves musically, that the artistic musical side came out in my oldest son. And actually my middle son, my oldest son joined a band, and he was a guitar player, and he played all kinds of things.
Yeah, he was good too. He is good. Yeah.
So good. He still is. He made a lot of sacrifices for the band he was in. He was in it for 14 years.
Yeah.
Almost. Yeah. Right out of high school. And, I think that was his outlet for expressing his unhappiness. And my middle guy started playing drums. That was and he played a lot of sports, just about every sport. So that was his outlet. And my youngest guy just stayed on the down low, just stayed out of everybody's way. And that was his way of dealing with, maybe the unhappiness in our family that I created. But it was a nice outlet for all of us to go see him and celebrate his talent.
Yeah, I could always see you light up when you talk about the name of the band was Chestnut Grove, and they have some music out there. The early stuff includes your son, and out there on Apple Music and Spotify, wherever you get your stuff. And you would just light up when you talk about him, and you were always so excited, and I thought that was great. You say something near the end of the book that I really liked. You say that it's not that everything happens for a reason, it's that everything happens for a lesson. There's a great analogy in sports. A lot of the top people in major sports say they didn't become better because of their victories. They became better after their losses, because you don't learn anything from winning. You learn from losing. You learn from mistakes. You learn from where you got to fix something. And, I know I've made plenty, and I've become a better man over the years. Well, talk to my Denise, and she'll tell you whether that's true or not. After identifying my own shortcomings, owning up to them and correcting or making up for them. And some of those shortcomings could be blaming yourself for things that just aren't your fault. And look at you. You got yourself a fresh new year and a half relationship or so with a bass player, which is the best thing you can be. If you can be a bass player, be a bass player. So tell me how your life is today. Now, we talked a lot about the darkness and everything. So tell me about your life today.
Pete, just going back a little bit about forgiveness.
Okay.
And I think that's a big part of how I can go on and be so happy. The forgiveness had to start within myself. I knew all the quote unquote bad stuff, that my mom did and my dad did and stepdad did. But then I carried that into my adult life, and I started making some of those same mistakes. And I think in being able to forgive myself, that helped me forgive them, because I have grace that came from somewhere, and I then am able to give them grace as well, for generational dysfunction that maybe nobody was talking to them about, that they had a choice. They could change their mind. They could be better. They could do better. They were just kind of stuck, where in the last 20 plus years, with self-help and transformation, and that boom, we've had different messages of change, some forgiveness and self-love. I think that has catapulted me into just a happiness I never thought was possible. I mean, I could just get so giddy about it, because I, so many, 50 plus years of unrest within me and in my nervous system. And now I'm just calm. I love my life. I look forward to everything that's coming my way. and I'm able to find peace with everything that was before me, before this time. And that just frees me up, frees up a bunch of space, you know, to look forward to the future. And really, it gave me the confidence to create the life that I want, not just a life of reaction, but a life that I want.
And I hope you do live till you're 90, as you say in your book, because you deserve to have all those happy years. That would be so awesome. My goodness. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, then you get to the end of your book, and then the words change in a new picture. And yes. The words are truth, and victory, and belief, and gratitude, and love, and peace, and freedom, and courage. You know, and I think that should resonate with listeners. You know, no matter what's happened in your life, you know, there are ways to value yourself and forgive yourself and forgive those who may have caused things to happen in your life, because you can't go back and change it. I mean, go forward with love in your heart. I mean, I wish, you know, the world's burning right now, by the way, and we don't really talk about that on this podcast, but you can get around even the world burning. Because you can go forward in love. If we all did that, can you imagine this world? Oh, my God.
Amazing.
Amazing. And, you know, I've had my setbacks, too, and that's one of the reasons I really enjoyed, and I'm not kissing your butt here. I really enjoyed your book. It was hard to read, but it was good to read. And it made me feel really happy for you. It made me feel that, yeah, I made some good decisions in my own life. That are similar to many of yours. It's important for people to realize that no matter how dark things were, it's never too late to take control of that and make it as good as it can be. I couldn't be happier for you. I mean, I told you before we started, this might be 20, 30 minutes, but this was a tough conversation. I'm kind of half teary-eyed here, even thinking about it. But I'm so proud of you. I wish people could have known you back when I did, and see your face just is completely different. You can tell just by looking at you how much of a change you've made in your life. And I hope that people get this book on Amazon. I got the Kindle version. Very inexpensive, by the way, so... Don't worry about that. I use my digital credits, so that even helped me more. And you can get the hardcovers out, right?
It will not be in hardcover.
No, paperback?
It's soft cover. Okay. It's a paperback, and yeah.
Okay, and they can also get
the ebook.
The ebook, which is terrific.
And one of these days, I will make an audio version.
Oh, that'll be great, because that's what I do mostly. I listen to things. It's hard to...
I'm looking forward to doing that.
The older I get, when I start reading stuff, sometimes I get sleepy. But I did this. Yeah. This did not get me sleepy, believe me. And I hope that people that are listening to this, I hope that some of them can take something positive away from this. And I don't see why they shouldn't, because you turned your life around. It was a difficult journey, but it was a worthwhile journey. And I wish nothing but the best for you. I hope my Denise and I meet you and your bass player, and maybe we have dinner sometime. Are you still in the area?
Yeah, I'm in Warminster.
Oh, okay. And I'm in Pottstown. So, yeah, that's cool. We can meet up somewhere maybe and have dinner and talk, and that would be really terrific. And I'm sure my Denise would love meeting you. So thank you so much for your time, Denise. Is there anything else you want to say before we...
I just hope that people take from the book that, you know, just that it makes them think a little bit. Like, what is the alternative anyway? I watched my mother, full of anger and regret, her entire life until she just suddenly passed away. I don't remember her ever being happy. It took me 50 plus years, almost 60, to get here. So what was the choice? to end up like her. I certainly did not want that. No. You know, I really want to enjoy my life. And I want people to know it's never too late. It's just never too late to love your life, you know. And thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I think it's great. And you're my first interview, so I hope it turns out well. And we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Thank you so much, Pete.
Bye-bye, Denise.
Bye.